morning. First case of the day is appeal number 01-1957, Donald A. Lane versus Michael Holmes and Mr. Casey. But thank you.
There's plenty of time for that.
Yeah, but thank you very much. That was nice.
Okay.
Good morning, Your Honors. May I please the court? My name is Brian Casey, and I'm here on behalf of plaintiff appellant Donald Lent. This is a prisoner civil rights case. Mr. Lent appeals the dismissal with prejudice of his Section 1983 complaint arising from his confinement in the Illinois correction system. In particular, Mr. Lent appeals the dismissal of two claims. First, his First Amendment right of access to the courts claim, which the district court dismissed as not being right. Second, he appeals the dismissal of his Eighth Amendment environmental tobacco smoke, or ETS, claim as being moot on the district court dismissed that as moot on the basis of his transfer from the corrections institution in which he was housed when the complaint was filed, Big Muddy, to Graham Correctional Center, which is where he is now.
Let me just clarify something, Mr. Casey. Is the access to the Maryland legal materials claim the only legal access claim that Mr. Lane is pursuing at this point?
You know, Your Honor, it's the primary one. In his complaint, he raised several right of access to the court's claims. He claimed that he was not given timely access to the facilities at Big Muddy, so he had difficulty filing his appeal in a prior action. He also couches his inability to obtain medical and scientific databases that he would use to support his environmental tobacco smoke claims in this litigation as being access of the courts. In his complaint, you'll see that he began the process on his own. He's asked on his own to be able to purchase that, not even asking for the state to pay for it. The state has refused. He couches that in terms of a right of access to the court's claim. Generously read, that may be more appropriate to be a deprivation of a property without due process, and in the event is wherever remanded for with leave to amend, that may be how that would go. But the primary claim is the right of access to Maryland legal materials, and that was dismissed as not being right.
Can I ask you a factual question about that? Does this record reflect anywhere whether the state of Maryland still has a pending indictment outstanding against Mr. Lane, or whether it has null pros the claim, or has done
this
anything?
Record does not demonstrate that. Mr. Lane has made repeated requests to the state of Maryland. He has moved for appointment of counsel at least three times. He has, I believe, sent additional letters saying, hey, if I'm not sending this to the right place, can you tell me what the right place is? And no one has ever responded to him from the state of Maryland. So according to Mr. Lane, sitting in his Illinois prison cell, he has no way to know. What he knows is that he received an arrest warrant. He was indicted. The state's attorney entered his appearance close to 6 years ago in the matter, the state of Maryland issued a detainer on him, saying they were coming to get him, and they never did.
Right. So the last he knows, under the interstate detainer provisions, there's a detainer outstanding.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
And he certainly asserts that is. There are a number of ways in which he has asserted that his inability to access the Maryland courts and get Maryland legal materials has been detrimental to him. And certainly in Lewis v. Casey, they say that at the motion to dismiss stage, only general allegations of injury are necessary to sustain a motion to dismiss, and he certainly has done that, but he's even gone beyond that and said, you know, hey, these are the ways in which he's been harmed. He's got this detainer which adversely impacts his ability, his station at in the Illinois correction system and things like that.
Mr. Casey, as a follow-up, you see, I was trying to figure the same thing out, whether or not his request for appointment had been denied or just ignored, because, you know, your brief says he has yet to receive a response from the court.
My understanding is
this brief says that he admitted in his brief that his three requests for the appointment of counsel were denied. So how, you know,
my understanding of the record is that he has never gotten any response to his motions, any of his motions for appointment of counsel, which is why he has continued to follow up and say, you know, hey, how do I do this? He believes that he has a number of very meritorious claims that he could assert in Maryland. He believes that the evidence used to indict him was the fruit of an illegal search in the state of Wisconsin. So he has a Fourth Amendment claim, a federal Fourth Amendment claim. He also has a state Fourth Amendment claim. They're not exactly identical. Similarly, he has, you know, because this thing has been outstanding for so long, he believes he has a very valid grounds to move to dismiss the indictment. Again, both on Sixth Amendment grounds, federal and state, and Maryland state statutory grounds, as well as the interstate agreement on detainers.
And I take it the scope of your appointment doesn't include representing him in this Maryland?
At this point, this state court has you know, appointed me to represent for the purposes of this appeal only.
Okay. And moving to your second issue for a moment, am I correct in understanding that when Mr. Lane filed objections to Magistrate Proud's report and recommendation, he indicated he was still suffering from the adverse effects from the prison system's
yes.
tobacco policies at Graham?
Yes, Your Honor. He filed a notice of change of address prior to the magistrate issuing his recommendation. In the magistrate's recommendation, the magistrate says, hey, you should, there's a suggestion of mootness here. In Mr. Lem's objections to that, and you know, it wasn't exactly the, you know, according to Hoyle, the way he did it, but he's a pro se litigant and, you know, did his level best. He asserted that, number one, his claims were still valid because the exact same things were happening to him at Graham. He, I believe, in the objections included affidavits to that effect, as well as grievances that have been denied.
Does that mean it's the same claim or a different claim? You argued in your brief that it was, in a sense, the same, in that it all flowed from a statewide policy, if I understood you correctly. But on the other hand, it seems to me lots of things might be different between big money and Graham, such as the size of cells, such as how many people smoke and how many don't, such as, you know, I mean, who do they house them with? It strikes me that there's at least the potential for a lot of factual variation. So if that's the case, then maybe he really is trying just to raise a new claim about Graham.
Well, Your Honor, there certainly is an identity of defendants. Mr. Director Snyder is the director of IDOC, and there are a number of letters going back and forth directly to Mr. Snyder showing that he has, you know, denied him the right to have a non-smoking roommate, both at Big Muddy and at Graham. Certainly there are probably factual distinctions between the two, but the lack of a smoking policy or the total non-enforcement of a non-smoking policy are, Mr. Lynn characterizes those as complaints against the, that are, you know, administration-wide, that are, you know.
The ETS claims appear, at least it seems, to be based in part on statewide policies of the Illinois Department of Corrections.
He has extrapolated from his experience in both Big Muddy and Graham and said, hey, the exact same thing has happened to me at Big Muddy and Graham, and the fact that Mr. Snyder is the ultimate person in charge and has denied his request at both institutions to say that this is a statewide non-enforcement of this policy. But you're right, Your Honor, to the extent that some of his allegations deal specifically with Mr. Holmes, the Big Muddy warden, that would be different. But in his objections, which the district court had prior to the time the district court found his claim to be moot, he said he specifically asked to have Mr. Bryant, the warden at Graham, be substituted for Mr. Holmes, and said, "Gee, I don't know if I have to file a motion because I can't, I don't have access to the federal rules here." So in his objections, he did the absolute best he could to try and posture this correctly. And in addition, he submitted additional grievances and affidavits showing that the exact same conditions, meaning that significant amounts of environmental tobacco smoke, the fact that he's in a almost exclusively in a cell with a smoking roommate, despite his repeated requests to not be so housed. So in many ways we're the same, but there are some factual distinctions. You're right.
Is he exhausted with respect to some claim at Graham?
He certainly has, Your Honor. There are there are grievances that are ultimately signed by Mr. Bryant, the warden, as well as I believe going up to Mr. Holmes. I'm sorry, Mr. Bryant, the
mm-hmm.
head of IDOC,
okay.
based on his tenure at Graham. Mr. Len believes that his access to the court claim is ripe because he's been denied repeatedly access to the Maryland legal materials. This isn't a case where the agency has yet to make a final decision. They've absolutely made a final decision. They said repeatedly he isn't entitled to. They don't have to get him out-of-state legal materials.
Isn't it true? I mean, it sounds like in part, though, Mr. Len is overreaching when he says, when he leaps to the conclusion that the failure of the library to have books about Maryland means that he gets to have a laptop with a CD-ROM.
Well,
it's like a big jump there.
There is a little bit of a jump, but in context, it's a little less than you think. As an initial matter, and the state points this out, there have been cases that say you don't have a constitutional right to a typewriter, but that's because that's about printing up a brief. If a court said you have to have typewritten documents, you may well have a constitutional right to a typewriter in order to have access to the court. But what he's saying is he needs a laptop with a CD-ROM because the library has no access to Maryland legal materials, as it's repeatedly said, is not interested in getting those, and he wants to get them on his own. And he actually, his prior case, said that he had issues with getting hardback books. So this is his solution, in addition to the fact that there are rules severely limiting the amount of space that he can have, he has to store his personal effects. So
how much longer does the sentence run? Will the record tell us?
The record will, it's still 2008, if he's good. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Sarah. Good morning.
May it please the court. I'm Assistant Attorney General Carol Sarah on behalf of the defendants Michael Holmes and Donald Snyder. Your Honors, Len's access to the Maryland court's claim is not ripe for judicial review.
Ms. Sarah, that I find a curious claim, given the existence of the interstate agreement on detainers and the fact that a detainer has been lodged against him, because it seems that the position of the state of Illinois is that even when another state has formally announced its intention to bring criminal proceedings against someone, and of course we see all the time that people are in fact sent to state number two or state number three for a trial in the middle of their Illinois confinement. They go to the other state, they get tried, they get returned to the state of Illinois to complete serving the sentence. It's the most routine of actions. I find it very difficult to say that he has no interest in pending indictments that are hanging over his head, because it's simply inaccurate to say that Maryland must wait until his release from Illinois to try him.
No, that's true. Maryland would not have to wait until his release.
Which means that he has the potential tomorrow of, I mean, the point is the case has already been filed. The indictment has been returned. The detainers, I understand his record, although I find the record frustratingly vague about the status of the Maryland prosecution, but I certainly see nothing on this record to show that the indictment has been dismissed or null prost or anything like that that would show that it's over in Maryland. And as long as it's not over, how can it not be ripe?
Well, Lynn alleges that he was served with two arrest warrants, one in 1995 and one in 1996. Although he alleges he was served an examination of both arrest warrants in the record that he has attached to his complaint, were not filled out, the lower portion. So it does leave an ambiguity as to whether there was sufficient service.
Does the state of Illinois contest that there is an indictment against Mr. Len in Maryland?
That's what Mr. Len alleges.
Well, are you contesting it? And isn't this a public record that could be procured?
Well, you did ask counsel if he had any further information regarding the status of the Maryland case, and I
did. Right, and now I'm asking you too.
I do have some, but it's off the record.
Is it a lie? I mean, if it's not a live case anymore, if Maryland has dismissed it definitively, that goes to this court's jurisdiction to adjudicate his claims about access to the Maryland court, because that wouldn't be a ripeness problem. That would be a mootness problem. So I think we need to know what the status of this legal proceeding is.
Well, yesterday I contacted the Montgomery County, Maryland State's Attorney's Office, and I asked them what the status of the case 78542 was. That was the main case that he's discussing. And they told me that according to their computer records, which are generated daily, that it was a warrant status, meaning as far as they're concerned, he was never served.
But he could be served tomorrow. It's not as if they don't know where he is. And
he's been indicted.
Yeah.
Who cares whether he's served or not? If there's an indictment that's been returned against him, he'll have to go to Maryland to face that. Either Maryland can trigger his coming there, or he has rights under the Interstate Detainer Act to...
Well, under the U.S. Supreme Court test in Abbott, which the court used to determine whether a case or controversy is ripe for judicial review, it asked the court to evaluate two factors. The first prong is whether the case is fit for judicial decision, and the second is whether there has been any hardship to the party from withholding court consideration.
But that's, of course, in a rather different, the Abbott Labs case is a completely different context than somebody with an indictment pending against him in another jurisdiction, which, as Judge Evans says, puts one in an immediate legal status, if you will, that of an indicted and accused person.
And for example, couldn't his release from prison at the end of his Illinois prison term be delayed by virtue of, Maryland's detainer?
Well, it is the department's position that because nothing has happened in this case, it's been pending since 95 and 96, nothing has moved forward, and there's been no hardship to him.
That's so difficult for me to accept, because, first of all, let's take case A, he still has the indictment pending against him in Maryland. Case B, it's disposed of somehow. It's dismissed on speedy trial grounds. It's dismissed on grounds for failure to comply with the time limits that exist in the Interstate Detainer Act. He is not in the same position, if in B, as he is in A, and you want to keep him in A with the indictment hanging over him, ready to be resuscitated at any moment, forever.
But when the case reaches a critical stage in Maryland, Maryland will appoint him an attorney who can file any motion that he wishes.
Well, but he has the right to get rid of an indictment against him that is improperly pending. Now, we don't know if it is. Maybe it's a perfect indictment. I mean, I'm certainly not expressing any opinion about the Maryland indictment. But it seems to me that the kind of prejudice that allows you, once the indictment is returned, if the indictment had never been returned, we'd have a completely different case. But if there's an indictment out there, look at all the time he's lost. His ability to collect witnesses, to defend himself, his ability to pursue that case.
Well, he said,
what if Maryland decides never to appoint him a lawyer? He has an interest in this, not just Maryland.
Well, he certainly could have pursued a speedy trial.
And how is he to do that with no access to Maryland materials?
Under federal law, he could have.
Well, but would you like to go on to the second claim?
Sure. Regarding smoke. Your Honor, Len's Eighth Amendment conditions of confinement claim became moot when he was transferred to Graham. If an inmate is transferred to another facility, his actions for equitable relief against the prison officials at the first facility are rendered moot unless he can demonstrate that he is likely to return.
What about to the extent that he was suing the State Department of Correction with respect to a statewide policy? How can that be moot?
Well, on the record, he has not demonstrated any present injuries from his incarceration at Big Muddy River.
But he doesn't have to plead facts. This is a 12b-6. This is not a summary judgment motion.
Well, in addition to the fact that he didn't have any type of injury, he only claims superficial ailments. He also he sued Snyder, who was not responsible for his cell assignment.
Well, he sought to substitute the warden of Graham, didn't he? I mean, in his objections to Magistrate Proud's report and recommendation,
but he never thought
it fairly clear that he was prepared to amend his complaint to make clear that the ETF claims hadn't been mooted by the transfer to Graham because he sought to substitute the warden of Graham. That tells you that automatically.
But he did not seek leave to amend his complaint. He mentioned that in the objection to the magistrate judge's report and recommendation.
Well, that then gets to the question whether, I mean, if your position is that he didn't file a separate piece of paper saying, I'm seeking leave to amend my complaint, you're right. I mean, I don't see anything like that in the record. I'm not sure that that means that the pro se litigant that his request in the other document wasn't good enough to bring this to the court's attention. Pretty clear. Why would you take such a technical view?
Well, I guess the other point is the fact that he hasn't pled deliberate indifference on the part of the department. That's a mental state that, you know, we don't know at this point on this record.
In terms of notice pleading, are you saying that this complaint wasn't good enough to put the department on notice that he was raising an Eighth Amendment claim, similar to the one in Helling against McKinney?
Well, it's just that he would have to allege that.
He eventually would certainly have to prove deliberate indifference. There's no question about that. And he would have to prove that it was a significantly serious condition, either for the present or for the future. There are a lot of things he would finally have to prove, but we aren't yet at summary judgment.
Mm-hmm. Well, the department would argue that this case is moot because he was suffering the ill effects at Big Muddy River, and then he was transferred there. He did get out of there, and then he was reassigned to Graham. Now, the department does have smoking policies in effect. However, with the overcrowding, it is not possible in every instance to accommodate all of the prisoner's requests. The vast majority of prison inmates smoke. And depending on the different facility, there just might not be room for a whole wing or a building devoted to non-smoking.
So should we never entertain any of these cases? Is that your point?
we should just en masse not entertain them? Don't we have to look at these case by case? In other words, in responding to Magistrate Proud's report and recommendation, Mr. Lane asserted that the Department of Corrections policies were still affecting him adversely at Graham. And as Judge Wood explained, we're not at summary judgment here.
Well, again, I guess I would say that the plaintiff simply did not seek leave to amend his complaint to tailor it towards Graham. When you read his complaint, he speaks only of the conditions of Big Muddy River. He suffered no serious injuries there, and he was transferred out of there.
Well, then why did he seek to substitute the warden at Graham, do you think? What could the reason for that be?
Well, he probably had it in mind, but he never actually formally sought leave. Nor was leave granted for him to amend. So on this particular complaint, he does not sufficiently allege a legally cognizable cause of action under Section 1983.
Well, shouldn't he have been granted leave to amend?
Well, that issue is not before the court, Your Honor, because he never asked for it. There's no way that it can be said that the district court erred in failing to amend his complaint, in failing to allow him to amend his complaint. And it would be abuse of discretion standard as well.
Anything you want to add?
In conclusion, I would like to say that Len's future injury claim is based on his exposure to ECS, and that the U.S. Supreme Court held in Helling that the plaintiff must show that he himself is being unreasonably exposed to high levels. This requires more than a scientific and statistical inquiry into the seriousness of the potential harm and the likelihood that such injury to health will actually be caused by exposure to ECS. It also requires the plaintiff to show that the risk of which he complains is not one that society chooses to tolerate.
And did the court in Helling say all of this needed to be in the complaint for 12b6 purposes?
It didn't, I can tell you. It was a different stage of the proceeding. It was. However, Helling also held that ETS exposure, objectively, is not a per se injury. So just because he is claiming that he was housed with a smoker does not mean that he was adversely affected. His bald allegation that he was housed with a smoker doesn't tell us how many packs a day the smoker smoked. He could smoke 2 cigarettes a month. Some of these cases actually say how much smoking was going on with the cellmate. One case says 5 packs a day.
God. He'll be dead soon anyway.
So. And lastly, I would like to say that Len does not have standing to challenge the IDOC's practice of housing non-smoking inmates with smoking inmates because he failed to establish the requisite personal stake in the outcome of this lawsuit. His claim is against Big Muddy River, and he is now no longer there. We ask that you affirm. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Fair. Mr. Casey, you have 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honors. Just a couple quick points. With regard to whether or not Mr. Len filed a motion to amend the complaint. He didn't, but as you pointed out in his objections, he very clearly stated that's what he wanted to do.
Do you want to keep your voice up just a little bit?
I apologize, Your Honor. In his objections, he made clear that was what he was interested in doing. In addition, on he includes an affidavit in those objections that demonstrates that his that the exact same thing in terms of being housed with a smoker were taking place at Graham as took place at Big Muddy. The site to the record is he numbers his pages BB, and the record is it's pages BB 31 and 32 is his affidavit, saying that in the approximately 5 months that he had been in Graham at the time, he had only had a non-smoking inmate as a cellmate for 2.5 days. To follow up on the point about the not filing a motion to amend, this court has said in a case called Donald v. Cook County that a pro se plaintiff should be permitted to amend his complaint to name the proper parties, or doing so would allow the plaintiff to state a meritorious claim. And again, a number of the issues that the state raised, they may be perfectly valid on summary judgment, but that's not where we are right now. It's Mr. Len's position that the district court in this case, at a minimum, jumped the gun. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. Mr. Casey, you were appointed.
Yes.
And you have the thanks of the court for the fine job that you did on behalf of your client. And, Ms. Sarah, you have the thanks of the court as well for the nice job you did for your client. All right. The case